Good evening. Trump lights a fuse in Kenosha. School openings delayed in New York City. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. On a trip to Kenosha, Wisconsin today, President Donald Trump promised $42 million to support law enforcement in the state. After touring some of the businesses that were damaged in unrest following the shooting of Jacob Blake, Trump also said he would provide nearly $4 million for businesses damaged in the turmoil and $1 million to Kenosha's law enforcement. While speaking to local business leaders, Trump didn't mention the name of Jacob Blake once, hospitalized after being shot seven times in the back by a Kenosha cop. But Trump did defend police, who he likened to sports stars who miss an easy shot under pressure.
Under this tremendous pressure, and they don't handle it well. They call it choking, and it happens. And no, but I don't believe that at all. I think they're... I've met so many police. I have the endorsement of, like, so many, maybe everybody. And frankly, I think they're incredible people.
For structural change, what is your message?
Well, I think people are calling for structural change, and then you could take the people of Kenosha that aren't here and that you won't see and that aren't protesting, but they want change also. They want to see law and order. They want the police to be police. They want the police to do what they do better than anybody else in the world, and that's what they want, too. You don't see them marching and you don't see them on the streets. But what they want is they want great police force. They want people that are going to keep them safe, where their houses aren't broken into, where they're not raped and murdered. That's what they want. And they're protesters, too, but they don't walk down the street, up and down the street.
Attorney General Bill Barr accompanied Trump. He promised the full weight of federal law enforcement against protesters.
There are task forces of federal and state officers reviewing all the video that we can get our hands on. And when we are able to identify people who committed crimes in these riots, going all the way back to the beginning, whether they're burning police cars or throwing rocks at people, which are deadly, they will be prosecuted. That's a large-scale effort, and it's going to continue.
Barr referred to so-called fusion centers set up after the World Trade Center attacks to track terrorism. A recent leak of Fusion Center documents, called Blue Leaks, shows these centers have been used more against peaceful protesters, with no arrests of alleged terrorists since they were founded. Wisconsin's Democratic governor and the city's Democratic mayor both had urged Trump to avoid Kenosha to prevent inflaming tensions and allow citizens to heal, but the president dismissed their appeals. Yesterday, speaking near Pittsburgh, Democratic nominee Joe Biden said rioters and looters should be arrested, but he also lashed out at Trump, saying the president is fomenting the violence.
Trump and Pence are running on this, and I find it fascinating. Quote, "You won't be safe in Joe Biden's America." And what's their proof? The violence we're seeing in Donald Trump's America. Rioting is not protesting. Looting is not protesting. Setting fires is not protesting. None of this is protesting. It's lawlessness, plain and simple. And those who do it should be prosecuted. You know, he may believe mouthing the words law and order makes him strong. Does anyone believe there'll be less violence in America if Donald Trump is reelected? We need justice in America. We need safety in America.
Democratic nominee Joe Biden. Biden's campaign has said he will go to Wisconsin, where he has a lead in the polls. Kenosha has become one of the flashpoint cities where anti-racist demonstrators have clashed with Trump supporters who have converged on protest sites, sometimes openly carrying arms while vowing to protect property from looters. And the coronavirus outbreak that brought two disastrous months and 35 deaths to the Sun Belt in the southern part of the United States this summer appears to be easing. Seven of the nine states along the nation's southern and western rim are seeing drops in cases. The U.S. leads the world in both coronavirus deaths and confirmed infections after a spring outbreak centered around New York City, followed by the flare-up across the Sun Belt over the summer. As of Tuesday, there were more than 25.3 million confirmed cases and over 850,000 deaths worldwide, according to the tally kept by the Johns Hopkins University, with the United States accounting for more than 6 million infections and 183,000 of the dead. In New York, which has gained some control over the outbreak with strict mask laws and months-long lockdown, Mayor Bill de Blasio decided in consultation with the city's teachers union to postpone opening city schools to what had been called blended learning. Blended learning is a combination of in-person and remote computer-based schooling. After a dispute with the United Federation of Teachers, threats of a strike, and the principals union, the city decided to move school back to the end of the month.
But I'm pleased to report that we've come to an agreement to move forward, to address real concerns that have been raised about how to do things the right way, how to do them the safe, healthy way, how to make sure people are prepared for the school year under absolutely unprecedented conditions. These challenges required a thoughtful approach. And what we've agreed to is to make sure that the health measures are in place, to make sure there is time for the appropriate preparation for our educators, to make sure that we can have the smoothest beginning of the school year, even under extraordinarily challenging conditions, and to move forward in a spirit of unity.
The mayor laid out the new school opening schedule.
The normal school year, educators, staff are in their buildings by the day after Labor Day, and that will be true here as well, Tuesday, September 8th. The school days, instructional days, were slated to begin September 10th. We're going to hold that for a few days. We're going to allow preparation days for our educators and staff to get ready under these unprecedented circumstances. So September 10th and 11th, September 14th and 15th will be days devoted to preparation, to really making sure that blended learning can work for everybody, that everyone understands their role, everyone has had a chance to practice together and coordinate. There's been an opportunity to communicate with families. And then, starting on the 16th of September, we'll have a three-day transitional period, only 3 days. For those 3 days, instruction will begin remotely for all students. During that transitional period, there will be instruction for students, but there will also be additional preparation for educators and staff. And then on September 21st, Monday, the school buildings open full strength. We go to blended learning, as has been described previously. We have students coming into the buildings. What would have happened on September 10th now happens on September 21st. So it's blended learning. Some kids in school one day, other kids in school another day. The buildings will be open and operational and taking kids into for that crucial in-person learning. And one of the things I want to say we affirmed in these discussions is nothing replaces in-person learning. Our educators have been clear that as important as it is to provide the very best remote learning we can to address the digital divide, provide free devices and internet service for kids, do everything we can to make remote work, nothing is as powerful as in-person learning. So that will begin on Monday, September 21st.
The mayor also described the testing regimen aimed at catching any outbreaks of the coronavirus in a school.
We'll be doing a monthly medical monitoring process that's been worked through by our health leadership, Dr. Jay Varma and Dr. Dave Choksi, along with medical leadership representing the United Federation of Teachers. And they've agreed on a plan that will make sure that testing happens on an ongoing basis, but I want to emphasize, in a way that is convenient and easy and straightforward for everyone in the school community and, of course, is free. So that on top of everything else that we've laid in place, ample supply of face masks and PPE, constant cleaning of our schools, including electrostatic cleaning, social distancing throughout the school day, pods so small number of students and staff stay together, a host of measures to keep everyone safe, again, the strongest standard in the world.
School Chancellor Richard Carranza said safety was his paramount concern.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. I want to add my voice in thanking the leaders of our unions, our labor partners, for never walking away from the tough issues that we've been grappling with. So I want to thank them for staying engaged and working through all of these difficult issues. For 6 months now, we've been charting a path for public education, and we've been working night and day with our labor partners to make sure that our school leaders, our educators, our nurses, custodians, food service workers, school safety agents, everyone that is in a school building is ready for the new school year. Sometimes that means taking a few extra days to prepare, which is what we're announcing here today. Teachers who usually get 2 days of professional development at the beginning of the school year, and we all know this is going to be a school year unlike any school year we've ever started, will now get 9. And we've heard from our educators, we've heard from our school leaders, we've heard from everyone in our schools that have said we need some more time. Students who haven't been inside a school building in half a calendar year, think about that, will have a chance to reconnect with their school, meet their teachers and classmates, and make sure that they have the tools that they need to be successful for this school year. There's a lot of groundwork that's already been done to lay the groundwork for this successful school year. This will strengthen and improve and make it so that we do have the safest start of this school year. What we'll do in the next couple of weeks is build on the success that's already been put in place and adapt where necessary, but it's going to be more important than ever that we remember the two words that we pivoted to remote learning with in March: flexibility and patience with each other, with our students, because we're all taking on something we've never taken on before.
School Chancellor Richard Carranza, United Federation of Teachers President Michael Mulgrew stressed safety of students was primary, but the safety of teachers and school employees was also his major concern.
So this is Michael Mulgrew. So what this agreement does at this point and what you're hearing announced today, it's very clear to every school now. These are the supplies and equipment that each and every school has to have. It's an agreed upon list. We can walk into any school and check to see if it's there. If it's not there, we can get that taken care of immediately. Then there is the list of here are all of the procedures that you need have to work out on how they work inside of your school. That's going to be part of the work that we're doing when the schools go back into place. We could say that you need to do social distancing, right, but how many entrances are you using for your school? Which way are you moving children in and out? When is bathroom time? All of these things have to be worked out at an individual school level. But there is a definitive list of what those things are. And then you have the testing components, which will get out to people. On top of that, we have an instructional plan. Majority of our instruction is still going to be remote, and we are all, which we haven't really spoken about, we're all making sure that we were proud of what happened between March and June, but we want it better. And we know we can do it better because we've learned more than we believe anybody else. We've seen school systems across the country just buy these for-profit educational platforms. They're all collapsing. They're not working. So we have to put all of that into place. But what the schools will now see is definitively what they need to get done. Now, it's our responsibility to help them get there. Certain schools will have greater challenges because of the age of the school and the configurations of the school. But that's why none of us are getting any time off. And we will not get any time off because this is just going to take up constant phone work, getting out to schools, doing different things. The union and the Department of Ed and people from school facilities have been going into all of the schools now for weeks. So all of this now is there for us to move forward. So if there's an individual school that has a problem, which we will have, we'll have to address it. But there's no longer a disagreement about what a school needs to have. And that is the key to what we're saying today.
UFT President Michael Mulgrew. District Council 37, a union covering school custodians, was also represented at the mayor's news conference today.
There was a silver lining about this whole pandemic has been that the war has recognized the work of people, everyday people who do work, you know, cafeteria workers, nurses, and people who sometimes get overlooked, right? Early childhood educators who did a tremendous job of keeping the kids instructed, even when the most challenging time. And so we are here for them, and we are pleased to announce that the reopening of the schools. I would say to them, we want to make sure that you are protected and that you're recognized for the work that you have done. It is imperative that we get back in the process of fully reopening the city of New York. And we believe fundamentally that the work that has been done will continue. But this plan that we're announcing today takes into consideration the monumental task of opening the school system. As the mayor said, more than 10,000 of DC 37 members have continued to work throughout this process, serving more than 500,000 New Yorkers every single day. Many of them actually work throughout holidays that normally are scheduled during the school year. As a parent myself, we understand the implications for our children. But we must get this right. And the only way we're going to do that is if we all work together, parents, educators, leaders, to make sure that the school system continues to function and is protected.
DC 37 Executive Director Henry Garrido. Michael Cannizzaro of the Council of School Supervisors, the Principals Union, acknowledged a big problem will be getting enough qualified staff into some schools.
You know, this challenge of staffing appropriately has been one of the things on our mind for quite some time, and it will continue to be. The commitment here, you heard us talk earlier about, you know, working together, and when individual schools identify problems, all of us coming together and working it out. And that was really one of the things that I was referring to when I said that we're going to need this team approach. We're going to need more people in the classrooms than we've had in the past. And Mr. Chancellor, thank you for recognizing the difficulty of being a school principal as one of the most difficult jobs in America. I think it was that before the pandemic, and it's exponentially grown. But together with our teachers and our support personnel, we're going to identify the needs that we have, and then we're going to bring them up to the chancellor and the mayor's team, and we're going to expect, and we know that they've made the commitment to get us the folks that we need. So although we know this is going to be tenuous and difficult, we're confident that we will have what we need in order to, you know, have teachers, appropriate teachers, in front of children on a daily basis.
Michael Cannizzaro of the Council of School Supervisors. And Michael Mulgrew emphasized the unique challenges and hard work that got schools to this point in the midst of the pandemic.
This has been a difficult time for our city. And the things that we're going to still have to deal with are going to be difficult also. But I think it's incumbent upon all the leaders in the city and all the leaders inside of each school to take this spirit of making sure that we're working together, to make sure that what we're doing is in the interest of everyone who walks into that school building. Every teacher calls their students their kids. They never call them their students because they're their children. The principals call them their children. We take very seriously the responsibility to keep them safe. We take it very seriously when we're talking to their parents that we want them to know we're doing everything in our power to keep their children safe. But we also want to make sure that we're doing everything in our power as a city to keep the people who are doing that phenomenal work in our schools every day safe also. And that's what we're here today to announce. But we're also announcing at the same time that we all understand we now have another difficult road to go down. The amount of work that is going to have to be done over the next couple of weeks just to get all of our schools prepared and ready to go, and then make sure that we're all doing everything in our power to keep each and every school system safe and school safe. But if there's a problem, all being there together to say, we will bring relief quickly and we will make sure that no school is being left out there to struggle on their own. That is the commitment and the announcement that you are hearing from all of us today. It's not going to be easy, but I'm very proud to say that we did this at this moment, but now it's up to all of us to be there to support each other, to support our kids, and to make sure that we are the ones keeping the largest and best school system in the United States open, running, and safe.
And that's Michael Mulgrew, the head of the UFT. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. Journalist Tim Schwab just wrote an in-depth investigative piece called Journalism's Gatekeepers for Columbia Journalism Review. He writes about Bill Gates and his foundation, which he says Gates' generosity appears to have helped foster an increasingly friendly media environment for the world's most visible charity. 20 years ago, journalists scrutinized Bill Gates' initial foray into philanthropy as a vehicle to enrich his software company, or a PR exercise to salvage his battered reputation following Microsoft's bruising antitrust battle with the Department of Justice. Today, the foundation is most often the subject of soft profiles and glowing editorials describing its good works. Among those good works, helping education and in advocating for privately owned schools called charter schools. Schwab scrutinizes National Public Radio's coverage of the Gates Foundation and writes that since 2000, Gates has given NPR $17.5 million through 10 charitable grants, leading to many glowing and uncritical reports.
For years, they've been putting money into journalism, and they often earmark it for coverage of policy issues where the Gates Foundation works, especially education or global health. And so that earmarking in and of itself is a manner of editorial influence. They're able to elevate the policy issues on which they work to draw more attention and more reporting to their pet projects. And that's different than when a newsroom sort of democratically, if you will, just looks at all the priorities, all the different news topics, and decides for themselves, what's the most important thing to cover.
You have the Koch brothers. I mean, they're pretty clear. They're anti-environmental. They finance a lot of science that undermines people's the idea that global warming is as critical a situation as it is. It's been said. How does Gates isn't as conservative as Koch? What's wrong with what he does? What are his priorities?
There are quite a few through lines with the Koch brothers. You're right. He's not as conservative, but on an issue like education, they, in many places, they kind of work in common cause. And a lot of this is around a kind of effort towards privatization, for example, promoting charter schools, which are privately managed, privately run public schools. That's one example. The Gates Foundation, the Koch brothers, they have been very influential in U.S. education. And insofar as our news outlets, the sort of educational reporters and the education beat is being bankrolled by the Gates Foundation, that absolutely bears scrutiny. Bigger picture, again, it's not just about how reporters cover the policy issues that Gates is interested in, but also how they cover the Gates Foundation itself.
And how's that?
It's hard to ignore the $17.5 million that the Gates Foundation has given to NPR, for example. And it's hard to ignore the hundreds of stories that NPR will put out about the Gates Foundation, not all of which have critical voices, many of which will only have the Gates Foundation's voice. I think we have to put those two facts side by side and raise questions.
How has that affected NPR's coverage, in your opinion?
NPR does do critical reporting of the Gates Foundation. There is no absolute power. This is a complicated issue. And I think, we all owe it to ourselves to, respect the complexity of this topic. It's not an absolute sort of influence that the Gates Foundation has. So it's not that the NPR never does critical reporting on the Gates Foundation. But I think you have to raise the question, could or should they be doing more critical reporting and maybe less favorable reporting?
Tim Schwab just wrote the in-depth investigative piece, Journalism's Gatekeepers, for Columbia Journalism Review. And let me take a moment, because WBAI is always asking for your support, and we depend upon your support and not the support of large funders such as the Gates Foundation. This is a perfect time for folks who listen to WBAI News and whose favorite program is the WBAI News to become a listener member of WBAI in the name of your favorite show, which I hope, since you're listening, is the WBAI Evening News. The number to call, 516-620-3602. Again, 516-620-3602 to become a WBAI buddy. In the name of the WBAI Evening News, your favorite show. And that's some of the news for Tuesday, September 1st, 2020. The news is produced by Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. From New York City, for the WBAI News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.